On this episode of Newt's World, my guest is known as Mr. Mars for his pioneering efforts and writing on Mars and why we need to colonize it. And I have to say, there are not many people who I admire more because of his consistency, his commitment, his energy, and the fact that when we finally land on Mars to stay, he will have been one of the heroic pioneers who made it possible. I was reminded of this when I read Profound Potential of Elon Musk's new rocket. Dr. Robert Zubrin is a former staff engineer at Lockheed Martin Astronautics. He's now president of his own company, Pioneer Astronautics. He's also the founder and president of the Mars Society, an international organization dedicated to furthering the exploration and settlement of Mars, and the author of over 200 publications and several books, including, most importantly, The Case for Mars, The Plan to Settle the Red Planet, and Why We Must, which was originally published in 1996, and he has recently released the updated 25th anniversary. First, I'll just say thank you, Robert, for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
You were a science teacher for 7 years before becoming an engineer. You have a bachelor's in math, a master's in nuclear engineering, another master's in aeronautics and astronautics, and a PhD in nuclear engineering. So you clearly have more than enough academic credentials for this. But I'm curious, what got you involved with Mars?
Well, what actually first got me involved with space, if you want to know, was Sputnik. I was 5 when Sputnik flew. And it's actually the first, you know, major world event that I can remember in terms of my personal experience. And while it was terrifying to many of the adults, to me as a little kid, it was just grand. Because what it meant was that these stories, I was already in science fiction, that I was reading about the spacefaring future were going to be true. And I wanted to be part of it. So I just learned all the science I could, launched rockets. My father got me a telescope. You know, I was 9 when Kennedy made his speech committing us to go to the moon. I was 17 when we landed on the moon. You know, during the 60s, we were moving out. But then in the early 70s, it all came to a screeching halt while I was in college. And I was a first generation of my family to go to college. And so grad school didn't even occur to me. You went to college and then you got a trade, you went out. So, okay, well, I know a lot of science. I'll be a science teacher. And I did that for 7 years or so. But then, you know, I started to hear the drum, as it were. I said, you know, this isn't what I signed up for. And by then I had heard of graduate school. And so I went back and became an astronautical engineer and got hired by Martin Marietta, which is now Lockheed Martin, and worked there for a time. And then I decided to go out on my own.
I mean, I think you're most famous for both your book, The Case for Mars, and for having founded the society which is committed to getting us to Mars. Did you expect to be involved in this kind of long-term educational, political structure?
Well, I mean, to be frank, Newt, I was hoping we could do this a bit faster than it has turned out. Because, you know, to me, growing up during Apollo, you know, humans to Mars, which, by the way, by the 90s was a less of a technical challenge than going to the moon was in the 60s. Why can't we just do this? And it's taken longer. I think one advantage they had in the 60s was I think the political class had grown up and tested in World War II and Cold War. And, you know, they knew how to work together to get things done. I think there's been entropy there. And NASA, the young NASA, was very virile and bold, but it got old. And it took a new force that has emerged on the scene to really get us moving in, and that's entrepreneurial space. And I'm proud to say that Mars Society helped recruit Elon Musk to the cause of Mars, but his accomplishments are his own, and nothing can stop an idea's time has come if the idea has messengers that can help it recruit to its banners the forces necessary for its victory. And we helped do that, and now he's doing it. And, you know, what he and SpaceX have managed to prove is that it's possible for a well-led entrepreneurial team to do things that were previously thought to require the efforts of the governments of superpowers. And not only that, do it in one-third the time at less than one-tenth the cost, and even do things they had deemed impossible altogether, including reusable launch vehicles that could, you know, come back and land at the launch site instead of just being crashed into the ocean. And this, of course, is the key to cheap spaceflight, cheap enough to make possible the settling of space. Because if air travel, if you had to throw away your airliners after each flight, clearly air travel would only be a thing for billionaires.
Musk has had a very methodical approach to this, building a relatively small rocket, testing out the ability to land and reuse it. And I think he has at least one rocket now that has been reused more than 10 times.
You're correct on that, but his method has been incredibly bold, methodical to be sure, but he's not afraid of failure. They failed 5 times in attempting to reuse and land the rocket before they succeeded. They just kept going.
And all of us have now, all of us at least who care about space, have watched the degree to which the Falcon 9 has dramatically reduced costs, increased the ability to do things. But part of that also is, and I frankly don't fully understand this, even though I loved your article, but Starship is apparently a different kind of beast. There's as big a jump over Falcon as Falcon was over non-reusable traditional rockets. And I think this is really what Musk has been aiming at the whole time, is to be able to acquire the knowledge and the capacity to build an enormous number of starships. But could you explain the difference in size and in capability between the Starship and the Falcon 9?
Sure. The Starship is going to have about 5 times the payload capability of the Falcon 9, and yet actually be cheaper to launch, because the Falcon 9 is mostly reusable. The Starship is fully reusable. Falcon 9 has a first stage with 9 engines. That part is reused. The upper stage with 1 engine is expended. The Starship is a much bigger vehicle than the Falcon 9. And Falcon 9 has a payload capacity of 20 tons, which is quite respectable. That's as much as a space shuttle. But Starship is more payload capability approaching that of the Saturn V moon rocket. And it's quite the leap. If you were flying a small aircraft, DC-3, and expended it with each flight, that would still be more expensive than flying a 747, which is reusable. And so that's really the jump being made here. Now, it's quite the leap, but you can see how they're pushing this forward, that they launch, and they got through most of the flight envelope, and then they crashed, and they did the same thing again. And then they actually landed it, but it was a hard landing, and 45 minutes after it landed, it exploded. Okay? And they tried 5 times before they got it right. But, you know, Musk's philosophy is, I mean, I visited him down there a year ago, and Boca Chica, they weren't building a ship, they're building a shipyard. And they're turning these things out. He said he was going to be turning them out at a rate of 1 a month, and he actually is turning them out at a rate of 1 a month. And so you can afford to launch, crash, find out what went wrong, and try again.
Congressman Bob Walker and I, in the late 80s, actually got money appropriated to NASA to build a reusable rocket. And I think it was about a $400 million contract, ultimately. And I think it was Lockheed that got the contract. But they tried a design that just didn't work. And so they quit and they walked off.
Okay, so that was the X-33, as I recall, during the 90s. And, well, first of all, I think that contract should not have been awarded to Lockheed Martin. It should have been awarded to McDonnell Douglas, who were the people who had pushed the whole concept of the reusable launch vehicle. Once you put a contract on the table, Lockheed bid it, and they wrote a nicer proposal, but they were not passionately committed to the success of the thing. And I think that ultimately showed. I mean, I think what you're seeing with SpaceX is the power of passion. They didn't give up after the first one crashed. Actually, Musk, you know, the Falcon 1, his very first launcher, the first 3 launches all failed. And he was not expecting that. He was naive at that point. But nevertheless, when he got hit in the face with the reality, how hard it is, he just kept going because he was committed. You know, he's not doing this for the money. This guy knows a lot of easier ways to make money than a rocket company. But he's doing it because he wants to do something of eternal significance. and that underlies his priorities.
I was invited by Vice President Pence to be sort of an informal advisor to the National Space Council, and so I had access to a lot of the NASA stuff. And one of the things we could never break, which I think was just pure raw politics, was when you look at Starship as an example, I don't see any case anymore for funding the Space Launch System. I mean, it's been an enormous boondoggle, a huge amount of money wasted, no achievement. They haven't gotten to the first launch after something like 8 or 9 years.
It's been longer than 8 or 9 years. I was on the team that did the preliminary design of SLS in 1988.
In 1988?
Yes. It's been 33 years.
You just added to my knowledge base. That's astonishing.
Yeah. I mean, there's people working on SLS that weren't born yet when the project was begun.
That's remarkable. I mean, at one level, it shows some farsightedness at NASA that in the 1988, they were willing to at least look at a large lift rocket, even if they couldn't find the political will to execute it.
Well, the original idea, you see, all SLS is, it's the shuttle without the orbiter. I mean, that's literally what it is. We were trying to figure out how to put together a heavy lift launch vehicle using the then available technologies, which was the shuttle components, the solids, the SSMEs, the external tank, so forth. And so this was the answer, was the obvious answer in 1988. And it could launch from the shuttle pads and it would use more or less all the shuttle launch infrastructure and it'd be simpler than the shuttle. And, you know, in 1993, Administrator Golden, the space station program was in trouble. He called a Blue Ribbon Committee, which was headed by the very eminent MIT professor Jack Karabrock, to figure out how are we going to launch this space station? How are we going to get this job done? And the Karabrock group came up with that you should develop this vehicle, a shuttle-derived heavy lift launch vehicle, and then you could launch the space station in 3 or 4 launches. But he was overruled by Al Gore, who wanted to have a space station that involved at least 30 launches so that he could bring in the Russians and transfer money to this crowd around Yeltsin. And they were basically using the space station program as a method of financial support to the Yeltsin crowd. And so we got this thing that ended up taking more than 2 decades to construct, and we didn't have the heavy lift launch vehicle. And then what happened was, yes, then Mike Griffin, when he wanted to go back to the moon, revived the plan. But by then, and especially by 2010, at which point the space station was done and you could shift resources from the shuttle program to developing the heavy lifter, all the people in NASA who had developed the space shuttle, not all, but almost all, had retired. See, if we had developed what is now called SLS, but then called the Ares, in the late 80s, early 90s, you would have had the very same team that had developed the shuttle were still at their posts. But instead, this job was handed over to a generation that had never done anything like this before. And the program has not been well led. And also, it's been subject to political winds coming from all different directions. So it's been a mess.
Does Starship begin to make it obsolete?
Yeah, if the Starship is successful, it will make SLS obsolete. You know, it's like SLS, if we had developed this in the early 90s, it would have had a nice 25-year career of helping our space program with heavy lift capabilities and be ready for honorable retirement. But by the time this thing has appeared, instead of developing the P-51 Mustang during World War II, they had spent 40 years working on it and bringing it out into the field when all fighters were already jets. It's not the problem with SLS. The problem is SLS is coming in the wrong generation.
What's your guess? Is Starship going to work?
I think it will. I think it's going to be harder than Musk thinks. Musk is a very optimistic person, but I guess that's one of the things that enables him to accomplish so much. He thinks he's going to do it. It turns out to be harder, but then he does it anyway. You might call him a tough dreamer.
If it does work, does it revolutionize our ability to go to Moon and Mars?
Yes, it does. It's totally revolutionary. It's mind-blowing revolutionary. I mean, what Musk's done already has been a significant revolution. They've cut the cost of space launch by a factor of 5 in the past 10 years, when it had been stagnant from 1970 to 2010. It was $10,000 a kilogram, like it was some kind of law of nature. And now it's $2,000 a kilogram. Kaboom. And the Starship will make it hundreds of dollars per kilogram. And this is going to do a number of things. Okay. First of all, it's going to cause there to be a lot more space enterprise, because it's going to be so much cheaper to go into space. And the more space enterprise there is, the more space launches there is, the more spacecraft there are, the more advanced, capable, and cheap spacecraft are going to be, because they're going to become mass production items. And spacecraft designers will not have to be as conservative as they have been. You know, if it costs you $1 billion to launch a spacecraft, you're not going to take a chance on a new technology. If it costs $10 million to launch a spacecraft, well, sure, let's take a chance, if it will make the spacecraft itself cheaper or more effective. So spacecraft technology is going to advance. So cheaper space launch, cheaper spacecraft, both of them come together to make all sorts of space business plans much more cost-effective and profitable. And yes, the goal here that Musk has had is to enable space settlement. Now, you know, if you went to NASA right now and if you could convince them they could send people to Mars for, say, $300 million a seat, they would jump at the chance. They say, fine, okay, we're in. Let's do it. We've got the budget. We can afford send 4 astronauts, $300 million each, $1.2 billion, less than 10% of our budget. Let's go. Okay, but an immigrant going to Mars can't afford to pay $300 million for his seat. How much could the person of middle means muster if he really wanted to emigrate to Mars? Maybe several hundred thousand dollars by selling his house. How do you get the cost of going to Mars not to $300 million, but to $300,000? That's the target that Musk has set, and that's why he's been relentless. That's why he hasn't settled for the Falcons, which have taken over most of the free world launch market. Anyone else would say, well, this is great. I'm fine. I'm fat, dumb, and happy. No, he's moving on. Now, there's another reason why he's moving on as well, which is that the Chinese are hot on his tail. There's at least 5 companies in China, that entrepreneurial companies, if you will, that have gotten investment money that are developing things that look a lot like Falcon 9s. And there's no question that they'll succeed, because it's been shown that you can do this. And these people are very good at making things work that other people have shown can be made to work. And, you know, if Starship works, they'll make their own version of that too. And he's going to have to go to the next level. And so this thing is not going to stop. This thing is going to continue to advance. It's very healthy, competitive situation.
You mentioned the Chinese competition. What's your view of the way Jeff Bezos has approached this?
Too slow. Too slow. If he wants to compete with Musk, he's going to have to get out of his hot tub. I've been to Blue Origin. I've been to SpaceX. They do not compare in terms of the level of activity, level of expectation, and certainly the leaders don't compare. I mean, if Musk fails, it's going to be because he works himself to death. This guy, when I meet him, he's exhausted. He's running on 7 cylinders, but he's doing it, and his people are doing it. It's almost unforgivable how bad Blue Origin has handled this situation, because, see, Musk has shown the methodology, which is build lots of them, fly them, crash them, correct the problem, fly the next one. Now, that's not a business strategy that Lockheed Martin could adopt. They do not have the internal reserves. They have to do their work on contract money. But it's certainly a strategy that Bezos could have adopted. And the fact that they haven't even tried to fly New Glenn, he should set up an assembly line, start building New Glenns. The first one will crash, figure out what they got wrong, fly the next one, and get it right by the 4th or 5th one. Musk has shown that this is how you get it done. And Bezos just has not learned.
From that perspective, you emphasize the Chinese as the real competitor to Musk. How do you assess the Chinese program?
Well, the Chinese are coming on strong. People got to wake up here. Most Americans, our generation, think of China as part of the third world or developing country or something. That's not how the Chinese think of themselves at all. They think of themselves as the center of world civilization, which had a brief period in which they tripped and a century of humiliation, as they call it. But now they're coming back to claim their rightful place. And this is an incredibly talented people and energetic. And we're going to have to up our game if we want to stay ahead.
You founded the Mars Society, I think, 23 years ago. Are you more optimistic today? And if people wanted to join the Mars Society, how would they do it?
Well, I am more optimistic, even though, as I say, it's taken longer. Because we could have been on Mars, you know, 20 years ago, but we didn't. Now, NASA, I must give them credit, their robotic Mars exploration program has been a bang-up success. You know, the administrators did a great deal to set in motion a very effective Mars robotic exploration program. We're seeing that now. And rewriting the case for Mars, I had an updated version in 2011. The only thing I had to update was the robotic exploration part. There had been no accomplishments in the human exploration zone between 1986 and 2011. There have been plenty with the robotic probes. Now, since 2011, the big change is SpaceX. NASA Starship's going to reach orbit this year. I doubt it. Might reach orbit next year, but certainly by the year after that. And so look, 2024, Starships are going to be flying regularly to orbit. We're going to have an election. Somebody's going to be elected president in 2024. And if Starships are flying to orbit with 100-ton payloads, you know, for a total $10 million launch cost or something, they're going to turn to their advisors and say, could I have people on Mars by the end of my second term? And the answer is going to be yes. And they're going to say, well, is it going to cost $1 trillion? No, we could probably do it within NASA's existing budget. He's got the main piece here, the transportation system. It needs some other things. We need surface power. We need surface nuclear power reactors. That's really not something for SpaceX because it involves control materials. It involves a lot of other technologies, Mars spacesuits, Mars vehicles, machines for making propellant out of the Martian atmosphere. These are all things that need to be part of it, and they're hard for SpaceX to develop because they're not really commercial. See, he can develop Starship because Starship is going to make him money in the commercial market. But, you know, a Mars spacesuit, not so much. So we're going to have a public-private partnership. Let's meet him halfway. He's bringing the main piece. We'll bring all the little pieces. Let's do it together. Let's have people on Mars by 2030. And we can once again astound the world with what free people can do.
I had some hope, which I think will probably not pan out with the new administration, but that they might actually have made the moon by late 24, early 25. My guess now is that'll be pushed back a couple of years, but there will still be a project underway. What are your expectations or hopes for the Biden administration in space?
Well, Biden, you know, hasn't been particularly a supporter of the space program. He hasn't been an enemy of the space program. I think it's quite fortunate that if we have a Democratic president, it's Biden rather than, say, Bernie Sanders or something, with people who have a noted antipathy to not only the space program as a diversion of funds from things they would rather spend money on, but as representing an ethos that they reject, which is the pioneer spirit. Biden appears to be willing to move forward with the Artemis program on autopilot. I think that NASA's decision to award the human landing contract to SpaceX was a very good decision. In fact, I'm amazed by it because all bets were on the so-called national team led by Blue Origin, including Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and some others, which had designed a three-stage expendable lander which conformed exactly to the thing that had been on the NASA public planning charts. It represented a very limited capability, an Artemis mission perhaps once a year to the moon at enormous cost. The human landing system version of Starship, first of all, I mean, it's totally counterintuitive. It involves accepting a concept of spaceflight operations that is totally novel. This is not even an optimal application of Starship. Putting Starship in lunar orbit and refueling it with lots of tanker flights from Earth and then landing it and coming back. It would take 10 tanker flights to refuel it if it's stationed in low lunar orbit, or 14 if it's stationed at the gateway. The gateway actually makes the mission harder. But here's Musk. What he's saying is here's my plan. Okay, I'm going to have dozens of these starships. Let's say I have 24 of them, and they each fly once a month. Well, that's 24 times 12. That's like 260 launches a year compared to shuttle, which averaged 4 and maximum was 10 launches a year. In other words, if you're launching hundreds of starships a year because you've got 20 or 30 of them and they're each launching once a month, then refueling starships in lunar orbit with 10 or 14 tanker flights becomes easy, as opposed to the previous Artemis concept, which was one SLS, which for some reason can only launch once a year, even though the shuttle could at least do 4, and supplemented by 4 expendable launch vehicles, each bringing pieces of an expendable lunar lander to the gateway. Now, it has some implications beyond adopting this vision of spaceflight, where spaceflight's becoming like jet travel, where hundreds of flights out of every airport every day. It has implications, for instance, if you're using Starship as an ascent vehicle from the moon, it puts a tremendous premium on producing lunar propellants, precisely because the Starship is so heavy. Starship weighs 100 tons. If you're using a little expendable lunar lander that weighs 2 tons, then making its ascent propellant on the moon, it's nice to have, it's not terribly important. But if you have a vehicle that weighs 100 tons and you need 100 tons of propellant to lift it off the moon, then it's enormously advantageous to make propellant on the surface of the moon. Now, we've known for a long time that we can make oxygen on the surface of the moon because lunar rocks are basically half oxygen by weight. They're all iron oxide or silicon oxide or aluminum oxide or something. But now we know that at the pole, there's water, which means we can make hydrogen and oxygen. Either way, it's tremendously advantageous. So now space exploration has married itself as a critical capability to space development, which was not the case with the small expendable lander. What you do on the moon is not terribly important. You're just visiting. Here, what you do on the moon is important. And of course, the whole concept of Starship, which runs on methane oxygen propellant, is based on my Mars Direct plan of making methane oxygen propellant on the surface of Mars, because Mars has got water and carbon dioxide, and with the two of them, plus power, make propellant. And by the way, the other thing that goes along with making propellant is the power to make propellant. So this is going to make space nuclear power much more important than it's been so far. Now, if you need power in quantity, which you do, you want to start developing space nuclear reactors, starting with hundreds of kilowatts going to the megawatt range.
Did you always assume that the moon would be a necessary stepping stone to Mars?
No, that hasn't been my assumption. And actually, I don't think the moon is a necessary stepping stone to Mars, but I think that by becoming spacefaring, we get both. That is, it's like becoming seafaring. It's not that this continent is necessarily a stepping stone to that continent, but if you become seafaring, you can visit the whole world. And with Starship, we become spacefaring. And we'll be able to do the moon and Mars and the asteroids and build giant space telescopes and do lots of other projects, orbital research labs, you know, all these different things that people talk about. And surface-to-surface travel on Earth. You know, for the past 3,000 years, people have made money on the Earth's ocean. Some by actually trying to extract wealth from the ocean, like by fishing, for example. But a much bigger business has been using the ocean as a global medium for transport. Ocean is a low-drag medium collecting every port on Earth. That's where the real money's been. Well, space is an ocean surrounding the Earth of zero drag. And by traveling through space, you can go point to point on Earth, anywhere to anywhere in less than an hour. You can go Los Angeles to Sydney in less than an hour. And, of course, this kind of travel using expendable launch vehicles is absurd. It's not even worth talking about. But if you have reusable launch vehicles, like Starship, this becomes a thing. Last year, there were 100 satellite launches in the whole world, and SpaceX, I think, got about 26 of them, which is to say the majority of the free world launches. And with Falcons making it cheaper, pretty soon there'll be 200 launches a year. But, you know, there's hundreds of intercontinental flights every hour, and that's a much bigger market. And if Starship can enter that market, then these things, yes, they'll be hundreds, thousands of starships produced not just by SpaceX, but by its competitors.
A single starship would carry, what, 200 people on a point-to-point flight?
Well, they talk about 100.
100. Be sort of super first class.
Well, look at this. I went through the numbers, and if you only had 100 passengers, and maybe they could make it 200 because they're not going to have to stay in very long, but if you had 100 passengers and you were traveling Los Angeles to Sydney in a starship, and if the total cost of the flight was five times the propellant cost, which is typical of airlines, you'd probably have to sell seats for $20,000 a seat. Now, I have to tell you, Newt, I've never spent $20,000 on an airplane ticket. That's not my class. But there are people who do. And that is the cost of a first-class ticket from Los Angeles to Sydney right now. And those people still have to spend 18 hours on the plane instead of getting there in less than an hour and having half an hour of zero G.
Somebody once calculated that it is the same amount of energy to go from Los Angeles to Sydney and to go into orbit.
I get the same amount of energy going to Los Angeles and Sydney and coming back as going to orbit, yeah.
Okay. So when you start talking about costs, now obviously rockets are more expensive to build.
Right.
But if you have one you can amortize over 20 years, you're in a very different game than you used to be. Let me ask about something that isn't discussed very much anymore. Sputnik was one of the great awakenings. I'd already been reading Asimov and Heinlein, and then along comes Sputnik. And so I was growing up in the 8th and 9th grade reading Missiles and Rockets. And in that period, the great competitor was the Soviet Union. And they were actually pretty good in space. But largely now they've just sort of become an also-run. What's your estimate of the Russian space program?
Well, the Russians still have a significant space capability. They certainly have a lot of technically excellent people. They have some people who know how to do a lot of stuff. They don't have much money. If you want to know, I think that China is in the process of acquiring Russia. And if I was a Russian, I'd be very worried about that.
I mean, literally acquiring the country, not just the space program.
That's right. I think that this is a decision that Russians are going to have to deal with. Okay, they can either be linked to the West or they can become part of China. And while Russian ideas on human liberty are not as expansive as ours are, they're considerably more expansive than those in China. And I don't think having the government tell you how many children you can have would even have gone over in Stalin's Russia. So I think people might want to think, what is the consequence of Putin's policy of isolating Russia from the West?
That's interesting. I do think the greatest threat we face would be a Russian-Chinese alliance. And I think it would be very hard for us to cope with it.
I think we could cope with it, but we have to unchain ourselves. Okay? People say, how are we going to stop China? Well, you're not going to stop China. If you want to win this race, you got to start running. We got to become better. We have to unleash the kind of potential that we can unleash. We've been tying ourselves up with bureaucracy. You know, in the 1960s, it used to take 4 years to build a nuclear power plant in the United States. Now it takes 16. Well, in China, but also South Korea, it still takes 4. People think the nuclear industry is ancient history. Well, it's not. It's just been stopped here and in Europe. But there's 450 nuclear power plants in the world today. China has plans to build another 450 domestically by the year 2050. And there's markets for hundreds more of them in the developing sector. And we're not even a serious competitor for that. We need to become competitive again.
When you look down the road, to what extent is the failure of our education system to prepare enough people who can do math and can do physics and chemistry, to what extent are we disarming ourselves?
I think we're still quite capable of producing excellent scientists and engineers. I mean, I think that's the one part of universities that remain, American universities that remain excellent. But I think it would be good if we had a bold space program that would inspire many more young people to want to go into science and math. I mean, one thing I learned as a teacher is that anybody can teach kids who want to learn and nobody can teach kids who don't. And it doesn't matter whether you've got an LCD projector or working with chalk. It matters whether the kids want to learn. If you have kids who are excited about the adventure of science, if you have a government that has made science the great adventure by committing a bold space program, as we had in the 60s. You know, in the 60s, we doubled the number of science graduates we had at every level, high school, college, PhD, and in some fields, tripled it. And we've benefited from that intellectual capital ever since. That's what an aggressive space program would do for us today. You know, if you want to improve science education in America, you're not going to do it by more standardized tests. You do it by inspiring youth, because youth loves adventure. Let's make science the great adventure.
I want to thank you. This has been fascinating. You've not only written about it and talked about it, but you've lived it. What you're doing is very important as an act of citizenship. We will get to Mars, and part of the reason we'll get to Mars will be because of Robert Zubrin. So it's a great honor that you would do this chat with me.
Well, it's been a great honor to talk with you again, Newt.
Thank you to my guest, Dr. Robert Zubrin. You can read more about his books and get a link to his recent article, The Profound Potential of Elon Musk's New Rocket. An aerospace engineer explains why SpaceX's Starship will change everything, on our show page at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Debbie Myers. Our producer is Garnsey Sloan. And our researcher is Rachel Peterson. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. Right now, listeners of Newt's World can sign up for my 3 free weekly columns at gingrich360.com/newsletter. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.